Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn today about meditate before you have to medicate. How the omega-3 fatty acids treat type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. Being too cynical could lead to memory loss and dementia. Now, I don't like cilantro because I don't like the way it tastes, but I like what's in it. So we're going to look at the one of the best phytonutrient-dense herbs in the world, cilantro. Eat nuts and live longer. Those are just some of the many topics, always from peer-reviewed literature, that we'll be discussing. Then we're going to talk about, from our public health segment, is the epidemic of sudden infant death a medically induced syndrome? GreenMed Info did a special investigative report by Dr. Kelly Brogan, medical doctor in SARG. It'll surprise you. But for those of us who have looked at the truth about the safety and efficacy of vaccines, there's no surprise. You have that information fully referenced. The full article will be up on blog.garynull.com, where we post dozens and dozens of articles each day. Our commentary today comes from Professor Bruce Lipton from Resurgence. It's called Epigenetics. I speak about epigenetics a great deal on this program, but he was the biologist who explored originally the science of personal empowerment and explains how we are masters of our own destiny. It's what's in your genes, and how did early life experiences impact your genes to form who you are today. It'll be a very enlightened insight. Also today, we're going to take a look at a comment from an older woman shopping in a store, and a younger sales clerk wants to reprimand her about something, and so the older woman responds. I found it interesting. I think you will too. We're also going to look in depth today about things that matter. The United States of debt. I've just been able to get the latest figures today about how much do we actually owe. It's staggering. There's no way out with the existing system. There is a way out if we become more enlightened. I'll share that with you. Half of college graduates are working at jobs that don't require a degree. Well, that should tell us something. I'll explore that. Do we really need to go to college today? I think not for about 80% of the programs that are in colleges. For others, yes. I'll give more understanding of that. One overlooked reason why the middle class is in decline. I'll share those insights from Washington blog Charles Hugh Smith. As you see, we have a lot to share, and I always try to leave some time aside for our call talk back in the last 5 minutes or so of the program. Let's begin. Meditating is very important for us. We know from thousands of articles that it will lower blood pressure, lower triglycerides. It can even impact blood sugar. It allows us to clear our mind of a lot of random thoughts. And this is the latest from Rob Kress, GreenMed Info. Quote, seldom will you find a pharmacy dispensing recommendations on meditation, although it is a regular part of anyone's good counseling practice. I firmly believe that if we are, as a society, became more mindful, we would not only reduce stress and chaos in our lives, we would make a tremendous impact on our health, reducing the need for most medications. Meditation is one of the most powerful tools for our health and well-being. It's easy, it's free, it feels great, comes with no drug interactions, and has shown profound success in preventative medicine. Meditation can be as easy as breathing exercises, repeating an affirmation or a mantra, even incorporating visualization techniques. Plus, with the convenience of smartphones, you can download meditation apps to further guide you into a program that fits you best. In fact, how little effort it takes is could be 5 to 10 minutes a day. There is an old Zen saying, you should sit in meditation for 20 minutes a day. Unless you're too busy, then you should sit for an hour. Now, given the state of stress in our culture, there's something about this statement. I find it profoundly true. If the history of yoga in the United States is a sign of where meditation is going, we're looking at a bright future because more and more people are waking up to the power of meditating. Even though Hindu monks introduced yoga in the West in the late 19th century, it did not begin to gain steam until the late 60s and early 70s. And now look at where it's at today. So what can we reasonably expect by meditating? Well, first, we have about 50,000 thoughts a day, each of us, 50,000 thoughts. A Harvard study has shown that the average person is lost in random thought almost half of the entire day. Essentially, we become a society of chaotic thought factories. Now, much of the growth of meditation and mindfulness practice is based upon stress reduction. And for good reason. In our overconnected lifestyle and culture of chaos, where technology has practically built a wall separating ourselves from peace of mind, meditation has proven to calm the mind of over-incessant chatter, the worrying about tomorrow, while reliving the negative of the past. So, in conclusion, the takeaway message is this. Meditation just doesn't make you calmer, more peaceful in mind, and reduce stress. It reduces blood pressure, reduces cortisol levels, reduces pain, enhances your body's immune system, reduces depression and anxiety, fear and anger and confusion, increases blood flow and slows your heart rate, helps revert heart disease, increases energy, enhances memory, prevents cognitive decline, and reduces crime in areas where people regularly meditate. That would save us an awful lot of doctor visits, meds, and prevent disease. And by the way, one of the best teachers of meditation, and there are many, is the person who really should be acknowledged for having brought chakra psychology and chakra healing to the United States from India, and that's Shyam Bhatnagar. Shyam is probably the senior teacher of breathing and meditation, and he is with the Shri Center. He founded the Shri Center. Now, the omega-3 fatty acids are very important. There are now thousands of studies on how they help the body. The newest comes from the peer-reviewed journal Nature Medicine. And this was done at the Quebec Heart Lung Institute Research Center and the Institute of Nutrition and Functional Foods. And what they found is this. We know that type 2 diabetes occurs when the body loses its sensitivity to the blood sugar-lowering hormone, insulin. Now, insulin resistance can be an early warning sign for diabetes. And you know that if you're diabetic, you're more likely to also be overweight, have cardiovascular disease, and generally be consuming a lot of unhealthy fat and sugar. What they have found is this, that, and there's multiple studies, Federation of American Societies of Experimental Biology published, European Journal of Lipid Science and Technology, Public Health Nutrition, all published articles just in the last year on the omega-3 fatty acids. It helps you with diabetes. So, if you're a diabetic or pre-diabetic, and there are about 100 million Americans who are, make sure you're getting, I would say, on the low end, 1,000 milligrams twice a day. On the higher end, 2,000 milligrams twice a day of the omega-3 fatty acids. And if you have heart disease, dementia, arthritis, Alzheimer's, macular degeneration, you'll need more, but I suggest you not guess. I suggest that you get counseled by one of the 100,000 licensed holistic practitioners in the United States. chiropractors, nutritionists, homeopaths, dietitians, nurses, physicians, dentists. From the Times of India, published in the American Academy of Neurology, being too cynical could lead to dementia. A new study has revealed that people with high-intensity cynical distrust are 300% more likely to develop dementia than people who are more trusting. This was the results from a study by Dr. Ann Tolpanen and showed the biochemistry is directly affected by how cynical we are. Now, I can understand that, but I'd like to put it into a different perspective. I did a long lecture last night. It was 3 hours long. That's why my voice was just a little hoarse. And then I did, after the lecture, there's always questions for another 2 hours. So a little strained. Sorry about that. But it was on this very topic. Let me just put a little, just a small picture of what I see. I see that many times, either one or both parents don't provide us with the input that we need to develop in a healthy way. And because we have no choice, we are helpless, then we become fearful that something we've done or said was not pleasing. So we begin the process of either adaptation, which is maladaptive, or we become hyper-vigilant in defiance. And hence, the more that we're criticized, the more we act out, the more that we are told not to do something, the more we tend to do it just to defy him. And this is also maladaptive. But when you're young, you do not have the intellectual capacity to understand the context, the full context, and the emotional parameters by which a parent is guiding you. And it doesn't have to be physical violence, so that's very common. It's emotional trauma, especially when we don't feel that comfort that we need, that sense of complete security, that sense of being that is accepted for who we are. And then as we grow up in life, we feel that we have been betrayed. And indeed, many people have. When you don't give unconditional love, you have betrayed the spiritual uniqueness of life and the gift that we all are born with, our spiritual completeness, and the ability to manifest from spiritual completeness. Instead, we are given an amalgamation of some good and some bad, positive and negative. But we can't just sort it all out so easily. We can't say, okay, someone said something and did something and it was not appropriate, but I'm going to let it go. We don't let anything go. We accumulate and process it. Why do you think so many people are overachievers or so many people don't achieve anything are underachievers by intent? What do you think about all the people that when they do have some authority or celebrity status, they abuse it or abuse the people around them? There's a very well-known person on the left, one of the corporate 1% liberals, that is notorious for abusing their staff, yelling and screaming and condemning. As one person told me that worked for this person, it was like working on a plantation. This was an African-American who told me this. And I said, well, why'd you tolerate it? Why? Well, because, you know, you have no power in the system. Who are you going to complain with? Everyone in the system, this person has control over. So you just, like everyone else that you hear, you just, you know, you go away. Well, imagine what that does then. You come into a job. You're impressed by the person's credentials or what they've done on the air. And then you find out that they're really... That's the public facade. Behind that public facade is really an insecure, hypersensitive narcissist that is manifesting sociopathic tendency, hiding it, but not from the people who are closest. Well, then you feel betrayed. And then the next job you go to, and the next person who may be completely nice, you're not going to trust. That's one example. Another example is the people who don't really open up their heart chakras, their heart energy in a relationship, because at some point they felt hurt. And you feel hurt when you feel betrayed. lied to, deceived, manipulated, used. Or, on a more subtle level, to the more hypersensitive, you simply didn't get what you felt that you needed, and hence you were betrayed when there was an opportunity in life to give some young developing child unconditional love. You didn't get it, now you feel betrayed. And now that boy is that going to cause problems. You're going to act out all over the place, and generally hiding the real underlying reasons. So from my perspective, this idea that we are negative in our thinking, we're cynical, almost always stems from insecurity of self, but then projecting out upon others, making yourself feel like a victim and everyone else in your life for some circumstances to blame. And at the core is that sense of incompleteness. Where you've been betrayed, you do not trust. Where you do not trust, you do not have completeness. Where you don't have completeness, you don't have the authentic independent inner reaction that allows the spiritual energy to manifest. That's how I would look at that. Next up, cilantro from Prevent Disease. I'll tell you what they say. Quote, cilantro, volatile oil, is rich in phytonutrients, flavonoids, and phenolic acid compounds. It's very high up on the list of healing spices. In fact, it's known as the anti-diabetic plant. In parts of India, it has traditionally been used as an anti-inflammatory, and it can lower cholesterol. Coriander seeds were found in one study, it's part of the same family, to have significant hypolipidemic effects, resulting in lower cholesterol, lower triglycerides, which is good. It helps stimulate the secretion of insulin and lowers blood sugar. Coriander reduces the amount of damaged fats, lipid peroxides, and cell membranes. And for the first time, cilantro is on the list of foods with high pesticide levels. It's yet another herb which consumers should be purchasing organic. And it's an excellent source of minerals. And always wash it thoroughly. And you can also put a little hydrogen peroxide and apple cider vinegar and put it in water and then just massage the leaves, then rinse. And that gets rid of most of the pesticide residue if you have no other source of cilantro. But for a lot of us, cilantro has a really bitter taste. I don't like the smell of it. I don't like the taste of it. But if I'm going to throw it into a dish, that's fine, because there'll be other things that will disguise the taste, because it's also providing a lot of healing nutrients. Lastly, on health and nutrition, eat nuts, live longer, from Mylon Rodriguez-Paez. And here's what she says, quote, nut eaters had a 39% lower risk of death. Well, boy, that's a good statistic. Scientists wanted, quote, to examine the effects of eating nuts on the risk of death. They analyzed the eating habits of 7,216 people between the ages of 55 and 80. They assessed their frequency of nut consumption and later followed up on their health status for 5 more years. They found that people who ate more than 3 servings of nuts per week had a 39% lower risk of death compared to those who didn't eat them at all. Walnut eaters fared better, 45% lower risk of dying. All in all, participants were 55% less likely to die of cardiovascular problems and 40% less likely to die of cancer. They also found that people who ate more nuts frequently were more physically active, had lower body mass index of fat, smaller waist, and consumed more fruits and vegetables. So, and then it talks about which nuts are the best nuts. Stay away from the dry roasted salted nuts. And peanuts are not, they're a legume, by the way. They're not an actual nut. And also peanuts have arachidonic acid, which is a pro-inflammatory acid. So that's what I would suggest. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about how bananas can prevent strokes. That's good. How honey is the solution for antibiotic-resistant superbugs, along with ozone. And we'll also get into some other important health issues. Now to our public health segment. This is from Dr. Kelly Brogan, B-R-O-G-A-N, board-certified physician, and Sayer G.J.I. of GreenMedInfo, a very good site. I recommend it. And it's an article entitled, Is the Epidemic of Sudden Infant Deaths a Medically Induced Syndrome? Well, a new study in the peer-reviewed journal Current Medicine and Chemistry titled, quote, Sudden Infant Death Following Hexavalent Vaccination, a Neuropathological Study, lends support for the long-theorized link between an ever-expanding number of infant vaccines and sudden infant death syndrome. And let's just use some common sense here. What is the peak age for sudden infant death syndrome? 2 to 4 months of age. Now, what happens at 2 to 4 months? The introduction of 11 different vaccinations containing 16 different types of vaccines. So even the CDC has been compelled to address the seeming coincidence directly. Quote, from 2 to 4 months old, babies begin their primary course of vaccinations. This is also the peak age for sudden infant death syndrome. The timing of these two events has led some people to believe they might be related, with babies receiving multiple doses of vaccines during their first year of life and sudden infant death syndrome being the leading cause of death in babies between 1 month and 1 year of age. CDC has led research studies to look for possible linkages. Yeah. Is this the same CDC that has repeatedly lied, that has committed crimes against humanity? Let me give you one example of a crime against humanity where I believe, since there's no statute of limitations on crimes against humanity, every single scientist bureaucrat that was involved of or knew of and did not report on the Tuskegee experiment should be spending the rest of their life in prison. They allowed 500 poor blacks to go for 40 years spreading syphilis throughout the entire black contact of these individuals. And syphilis is very easy to spread. You do not even have to have sexual contact. You can spread syphilis with sweat or a kiss. Now, just imagine all the contacts, and then imagine the congenital syphilis is very hard to detect. The spirochete can hide for decades in the brain. And yet, that's the same CDC. Is that the same CDC that also hired a man who's now one of the most wanted criminals or wanted people in the world for committing fraud? Yes. And yet those were his studies that showed there was no link between vaccines and autism? Yes. Well, then shouldn't they have rescinded all of their studies? Yes. Did they? No. And so it goes with what I consider one of the most corrupt organizations in the world. But then again, I look carefully, and I think most organizations have been corrupted. Well, unsurprisingly, the CDC, whose pro-vaccine agenda is glaringly obvious in the 100-plus documented serious unintended adverse events of vaccines, as evidenced in the biomedical literature, claims extensive research they commissioned has found vaccines do not cause sudden infant death syndrome. Despite the CDC's dismissal, infant mortality rates are highest among countries that administer the most vaccines within the most vulnerable development window of infanthood. A study last year published in Human and Experimental Toxicology observed that, quote, the U.S. childhood immunization schedule specifies 26 vaccine doses for infants aged less than 1 year, the most in the world, yet 33 nations have lower infant mortality rates. End quote. They found that across the 34 nations analyzed, quote, a high statistically significant correlation between increasing number of vaccine doses and increasing infant mortality rates, end quote. Also, a recent study published in Vaccine, titled, quote, co-administration of live measles and yellow fever vaccines and inactivated pentavalent vaccines is associated with an increased mortality, that means death, compared with measles and yellow fever vaccine only, quote, found multiple infant vaccines dramatically increased the risk of death in a trial conducted in the West African country. While the 6 antigen hexavalent vaccines most recently linked to sudden infant death is presently only licensed in Europe, there are a number of mandatory multiple dose vaccines in the United States, including the DPT and MMR, which brings up the question, are the risks of adverse reactions, including lethal ones, amplified in multiple-dose vaccines? There are also a wide range of vaccines in development or already on the market which are being included or will be included eventually on top or ever-expanding immunization schedules. The hepatitis B, the MMR, Hib, tetanus, meningococcal, and ATAP. So, that's what it is. Now, one final thought from Dr. Larry Pavetsky, MD. Quote, even if vaccines only purportedly contain one bacterial and one viral antigen, as Varicella and hepatitis A do, there are multiple antigens inside of them, making them multivalent and in of themselves. And they are most often given at the same time as other vaccines, making these single antigen vaccines into multiple or multivalent injections. They can consist of bacteria, viruses, or even yeast antigens, as well as known environmental toxins and proteins and other contaminant bacteria, viruses, and yeast. By definition, all vaccines in and of themselves are marked multivalent. And despite the fact that the varicella vaccine contains only one reported viral antigen, the injection of this vaccine is still an injection into the body of multiple antigens, sucrose, hydrolyzed gelatin, sodium chloride, monosodium glutamate, sodium phosphate, dibasic, potassium phosphate, monobasic, potassium chloride, residual components of the MRC five cells on which the varicella virus was isolated, including DNA, protein, and trace quantities of monobasic EDTA, neomycin, and fetal bovine. That's in a vaccine. The injection of the hepatitis A vaccine, despite only containing one reported viral antigen, also contains the disodium phosphate and aluminum hydroxide and neomycin sulfate, polysorbate 20, sodium chloride. There are known pathogenic ingredients in vaccine schedule. They're contaminants. There's bacteria in the DAPT. There's bacterium in the Hib, bacteria in the Prevnar, viruses in hepatitis B and hepatitis A. There are three viruses in the polio vaccine. There are three different viruses in influenza. There are three in the MMR. So when they tell you that they have clean vaccines, they lie. So here it is. And there's just study after study. All this will be on the website later today. But it shows you that they've been lying as a public health measure. And why? Why would they lie? What would be the motive? It's simple. Our government bureaucracies are almost all with political appointees. Most of these people come from the very industries who have selected them to head the FDA, to head the CDC, to head U.S. Public Health Service, to head the USDA. These are all pro-corporate industry people. They become policymakers. And based upon the politics of Washington, an underling doesn't have a chance to cause reform. Those who do are thrown out, harassed, or attacked. And this president, with malice aforethought, goes after every whistleblower that wants to expose crimes against the public to the public. And this president and his administration and all the clones, human clones that he has surrounded himself with, and the corporate insiders, they want everything in secret. This is the most secret government in American history. And yet people will like him based upon his personality. After all, a poll showed that Bill Clinton's the most popular president since FDR. And take an honest look at his record, and you think to them, I don't have a problem with Bill Clinton. He is what he is. I have a problem with the people who have no sense of history and no care. And that's unfortunate. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on public health issues, health and nutrition issues. Now I want to share a commentary. This commentary is from Professor Bruce Lipton. You've seen Bruce Lipton in a lot of my self-empowerment films. In fact, I have 13 to 14 films I have filmed in the last 4 months, self-empowerment, and he's in several. I have not released them yet because I haven't finished them yet because we're putting all of our energy into the most important films we're doing, the big documentaries. But Lipton was the one who found that when he took the DNA, the gene, out of cells, they continued to function as if they had DNA. Well, give you an idea what that would be like. That would be like taking the engine out of a car and the car still able to drive. How's that possible? But it was. It took him years to figure that out. So he is really the person that brought us epigenetics. Here is his article entitled Epigenetics. Quote, science recognizes that stress is directly responsible for up to 90% of illness. In response to stress, the body shuts down growth processes, inhibits immune function, restricts executive conscious processing, collectively impairing the health of our bodies and our performance in life. Stress is especially exacerbated when individuals perceive themselves to be powerless in facing impending challenges. A particularly disempowering and stress-provoking belief held by the public is the notion that genes control biology and, to a large extent, the character of life. From early school through basic college courses, the media, the personal experience of family lineage, the public has been imbued with a belief in genetic determinism, the notion that genes turn on and off and control our fate. Since, as far as we know, we did not pick our genes, and we can't change them if we don't like our traits, we perceive ourselves as victims of heredity. If a disease like cancer, diabetes, heart disease, or a dysfunctional trait like Alzheimer's, ADD, or depression is running in a family, we presume it's due to those inherited genes, and that is our genetic inheritance that will cast our fate as future victims when we relinquish power over life to the DNA. Revolutionary new thinking in physics and biology is undermining old myths and rewriting civilization's truths. Since 1990, science has dramatically veered away from its belief in genetic determinism with the founding of the new field of epigenetics, which is the science of how environmental controls genes, emphasizing the Greek prefix epa, meaning above. The science of epigenetic control literally translates as control above the genes. Now, in departing from the notion of genes controlling life, epigenetic science emphasizes the environment, and more specifically, our perception of the environment as the factors that actually control gene activity. And while conventional belief in genetic determinism implies victimization, epigenetic science offers insights to mastery over life, since we ultimately control our gene-regulating environment and perceptions. Epigenetic science upends conventional beliefs and prompts a complete reevaluation of life as we know it. Epigenetic begs the question, if we are the ones that control our genes and lives, why is this world so rife with disease and ecological destruction? And more importantly, what can we do about it? To provide further insight into these conundrums, let's travel back some 40 years to when I was teaching medical students genetic determinism while carrying out research on muscular dystrophy and conducting a series of experiments that pioneered the new science of epigenetics. I was cloning multi-potential embryo-like stem cells, placing a single stem cell in a culture dish by itself. Cultured stem cells divide about every 10 to 12 hours. After 2 weeks, the cultures contain thousands of genetic identical cells, since all are derived from the same parent cell. Cells can split into three groups, each inoculated into its own tissue culture dish. A different version of culture medium containing a unique blend of chemical ingredients was introduced into each of these three dishes. Culture medium provides the cell's environment. In one dish, cells form bone. In the second dish, the cells form muscle. In a third dish, the cells form fat cells. The big question addressed by this experiment was, what controls the fate of the cells? Since all the cells were genetically identical, the answer was a no-brainer. The environment controls the fate of the cells. For example, cells grown in what is a less than optimal environment get sick, and those cultures die off. To heal cells, we did not resort to drugs. We simply returned them to a healthy environment, and they spontaneously recovered and flourished. This research revealed that cells adjust their genetics and behavior to become structural and physiological components to their environment. The culture medium environment represented the factors above the gene that control the fate of my cells. Culture medium is the cell biologist's synthetic equivalent of the blood environment that normally nourishes your body cells. But how do those findings in stem cell cultures relate to you? To understand, we must first correct a general misimpression. While we perceive of humans as single organisms, in reality we're skin-covered petri dishes containing approximately 50 trillion cells. Cells are the actual single organisms. Humans, by definition, are communities of cells. Epigenetic science recognizes that the chemistry of blood, the body's culture medium, shapes our genes and behavior. This naturally leads to the question, what controls the blood's composition? Answer, the brain, which is the body's chemist. Neurochemicals secreted in the blood coordinate our body's cellular activities in response to our perceptions and emotions. For example, if you open your eyes and you see someone you love, your brain releases into the blood dopamine, oxytocin, and growth hormone, neurosecretions that enhance cell vitality. Hence, people glow when they're in love. In contrast, when you open your eyes and you see something that threatens you, your brain secretes stress hormones and inflammatory agents. Blood with these neurochemicals and chronic stress conditions will shut down normal cell function and lead to cell death. Hence, stress kills you. Consequently, the top rung of the epigenetic control ladder, the factor that controls the character of neurochemicals released by the brain, is the activity of the brain. Epigenetic completely rewrites the limiting beliefs of genetic control. For the new science emphasizes the mind in controlling genes and behavior. And this insight reveals we are masters of our fate, for we are free to change our minds. More than a few readers may now be thinking, mastery, this can't be true. My mind would not have created this disease without behavior. To understand this apparent anomaly and recapture control over our lives, we must first recognize that the mind is comprised of two interdependent elements, the conscious and subconscious minds, each expressing different functions and different ways of learning. The conscious mind, representing your uniqueness, your source of your spirit, is the creative mind. Conscious creativity is the source of our wishes, our desires, our aspirations. In contrast, the subconscious mind is primarily a powerful record playback device expressing little creativity. It is responsible for automatically and unconsciously engaging instincts and complex learned behaviors, programmed as habits. The subconscious mind's primary behavior habits and responses to life, including belief about self-identity, do not necessarily express our wishes and desires. Between late fetal development and 7 years of age, fundamental behavioral programs controlling life are directly downloaded into the subconscious mind and simply by observing the behavior of your parents, your siblings, and your community. To accommodate the massive behavioral download during the a child's brain predominantly operates on theta EEG frequencies, a functional state associated with hypnosis. Neurologically, infants acquire a behavioral repertoire by observing the behavior of others. Passive hypnosis downloads enable an infant to acquire thousands of behavioral rules necessary for both survival and becoming a functional member of a family and community. Unfortunately, psychologists suggest that 70% or more of behaviors downloaded into the subconscious during our developmental years are negative, disempowering, and self-sabotaging. If our mind is programming our lives, why do most people have difficulty in manifesting their life expectations? The primary reason is we believe we are controlling our lives with conscious mind wishes and aspirations. Wrong. Neuroscience reveals that conscious mind control cognitive functions only 1 to 5% of the time. Consequently, 95 to 99% of our behaviors derive from our subconscious programs. The reason for this functional imbalance is related to a unique property of the conscious mind. It can think And while busy thinking, the conscious mind is not mindful of the current moment. When the conscious mind's attention is diverted, behavioral control is automatically defaulted to subconscious programs, which principally express the behavior of others. A conscious mind engaged in thought rarely observes behavior derived from default subconscious programs. And since the majority of its functional behavior programs are deemed disempowering, we unconsciously sabotage ourselves 95% of the time. Unaware of the subconscious mind's invisible participation, we unfortunately perceive ourselves as victims, blaming the universe or someone for our shortcomings. Knowledge of how developmental subconscious programs shape our lives is not new. Over 500 years, Jesuits have boasted, "Give me a child until it's 6 or 7, and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life." They knew the first 7 years of programming determines your life's path, in spite of your conscious wishes and desires. This knowledge has not been lost on those who have since shaped the world stage. As illustrated in the Hollywood movie The Matrix, we have all been programmed. What would life be like if we all took the movie's red pill and got out of the program? How would an empowered life unfold without the negative misimpressions and interpretations acquired in developmental programming? Interesting, most have experienced this amazing state. Have you ever fallen in love and enjoyed what I refer to as the honeymoon effect, a state of glowing health, overflowing energy, and life experiences resembling purity? Science recently recognized people in this state of love keep their conscious minds present, meaning mindful, 90% of the time. When operating from mindfulness, life experiences are created using the conscious mind wishes and desires, and only infrequently do we default to limiting subconscious programs. The honeymoon state is not an accident, but a personal creation derived from the conscious mind's control of cognitive behavior. In conclusion, unfortunately for most, the honeymoon experience returns to regular life or even divorce when the conscious mind becomes engaged with busyness of life again, and for that is when we unconsciously default to negative subconscious behaviors that sabotage the honeymoon experience. Replacing our limiting subconscious programs with behaviors expressing our wishes and desires would lead to a perpetual state of bliss for billions of people on the earth. The good news is that those disempowering subconscious programs can readily be rewritten. There are 4 fundamental ways to install new subconscious programs. 1, through hypnosis, the way we learned the programs in the first place, in the first 7 years of our life. And there's one great Dr. Michael Elner and Joseph Bemblich, 2 of the best I know. 2, through repetition and the creation of habits, meaning what I call spiritual discipline. Meaning each day, stay in the conscious mindfulness of the disciplines that you require. 3, and this is very important, you can individually rewrite programs after an overwhelming and psychologically traumatized life experience. Say you're diagnosed with a terminal, and I said this to the group last night. I said, how do we go from the problems to the solutions? The only way I have ever seen in my life is we must become mindful of how important our life is and what we still have to live for, and then start making a wish list, a fantasy list of all the things you have not done or not stayed with that you would like to do, and don't allow any no's. Remember, by the time we get 7 years of age, we have 80 no's for every yes. So the no's win, but not today. We're going to say yes wins today. Yes, I want to do this career. Yes, I want to be in this kind of relationship. Yes, I want to do this. Then that's your conscious focus. That rewrites a new story. And I told everyone last night, I said, take a look at your life story. Take a look at your story. How many times have you told your story to someone to convince them that you were a victim and you were right? If you are not a victim and you don't think of yourself as a victim, then you don't have a story. You just have a life. You either have a life or you have a life story. One or the other. So listen how many times people try to explain why they're a victim, why they can't unclutter their house. I just can't. I've seen it. I had someone who said they needed help. I went to their house. They opened the door. You could not walk inside. Literally, it was from ceiling to the floor. Yet if you met this person, you'd think they were charming and smart and witty, completely dysfunctional on every level. And coming from extremely toxic, negative perspective, but mastering how they became a victim. The minutiae of victimization and then associating with people who would try to rescue them. And that's the game that most of these dysfunctional people play. They try to live through other people's rescue, knowing full well they have no intention of changing. And when finally the game is up and the energy is separated, they find someone else. But they've never changed their story. So if you want to change your life, unclutter your life, have wholesome in your life, and freedom to be who you authentically are and were meant to be, then you got to stop the stories and the emotions behind the stories. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. And we want to get into this topic because it's an important topic that is rarely, if ever, discussed. The topic is hydrofracked natural gas, the new snake oil, and the false promises in the U.S. supplying Europe with natural gas in its new Cold War with Russia. My guest is Richard Heinberg. He is widely regarded as one of the world's experts in peak oil and its repercussions on the world economy, food and transportation, and the need to transition away from fossil fuels and create a more sustainable future. He's currently the senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He was featured in Leonardo DiCaprio's film, The 11th Hour. And he is also the person going out to help do the debates. He's the author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. His websites are Richard Heinberg, HEINGBERG.com, and postcarbon.com. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
It's very good to be with you again, Gary.
Richard, earlier this month, President Obama met with the Polish president over the conflict with Russia and over the Ukraine. And during his visit, Obama stated, quote, "It's going to be critical for Ukraine to embark on effective efforts to reform its energy sector and diversify its supply of natural gas. For our part, the United States has already approved licenses for natural gas exports, which will increase global supplies and therefore benefit partners here in Europe. The United States will be exporting more natural gas to the global market in the years to come," end quote. So Obama's also in U.S. supply of gas to Europe via the secretive corporate development transatlantic trade investment partnership, the TTIP, which is just as corrupt, just as vile, just as fraudulent, just as putrid as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I'm only being kind in my statement. But when we had Kurt Cobb and Nate Hagen on, yes, a few months ago, they indicated that the U.S. still depends upon imported natural gas to satisfy our present domestic gas needs. So even at home, we're not self-sufficient. So please deconstruct for us Obama's promises to the Ukraine and other European countries that the U.S. can be their arsenal for energy, he said, in the absence of Russian gas imports. And why is this more based upon political rhetoric and delusions than actual geological facts on the reserves of natural gas here at home?
Right. Well, as you just indicated, the U.S. is still a net natural gas importer, not by very much, less than 10%. But is that likely to change anytime soon? U.S. shale gas production has been flat for the last couple of years, and our analysis at Post Carbon Institute indicates that we're going to see declining U.S. natural gas production starting in probably a couple of years, something like that. It depends upon the rate of drilling. Now, currently, drilling rates for natural gas in the U.S. are down because most of the companies drilling for natural gas and most of the drillers are using hydrofracturing technology and operating in shale gas plays. Most of these companies are currently losing money on every cubic foot they produce. Natural gas prices are too low to justify operating in these very difficult geologic environments. So the industry wants higher natural gas prices so they can drill more. The only way they're going to get higher natural gas prices is if they wait long enough and U.S. natural gas production declines significantly. And again, that's probably only a couple of years away. The other way they can get higher natural gas prices is to export more. Currently, the U.S. exports trivial amounts of natural gas, but it imports more than it exports. But the producers can get a higher price for natural gas if they can manage to sell it to the Europeans or the Koreans or Japanese. So they're pushing for natural gas export terminals so they can raise the price of natural gas here in the U.S. and thereby hopefully begin to turn a profit. The problem with this scenario is that there are only so many places to drill, and they've been drilling for the last 5, 7, 8 years. They've been drilling at heroic rates to get this shale gas out. The reason they have to is that individual natural gas wells drilled in shale formations tend to decline very rapidly in production, usually about 70% in the first year. If you look at a whole shale gas play like the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, the overall play will decline by about 30 to 40% each year. That's taking into account both the newer wells and the older wells that are declining a little more slowly. So that means they have to replace 40% of current production with new wells every year just to stay even. And that gets more and more
difficult. That's not doable.
Well, it gets less doable all the time as they use up the best drilling locations. And it turns out, you know, it's not the whole state of Pennsylvania that's drillable. It's actually just a few counties where shale gas can be produced profitably from the Marcellus. So the industry is using up the best drilling locations as fast as it possibly can, meanwhile making these unrealistic promises about future production, which the government evidently takes seriously. And then our president uses that as a geopolitical tool to try to persuade the Europeans that we're their best friend rather than Russia. And if you look at the basis for all of these claims, it's really pretty laughable.
Richard, after viewing the available data on natural gas supplies in the United States, what is your assessment of peak natural gas, meaning we've reached our peak and now we're on the downside, and what do you envision as the future of natural gas in this country during the next 5 years?
Okay, well, conventional natural gas, which is what we were relying on until the shale revolution, conventional natural gas production in the U.S. has been declining for a long time. And the shale boom wouldn't have happened except for the fact that we were basically running out of conventional natural gas in the U.S., and that was driving prices up to stratospheric levels. So with those higher prices, the companies found it, you know, justifiable to deploy the new technology of horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing in these lower quality reservoirs, the shale tight reservoirs. And that, with you know, an enormous rate of drilling, produced a lot of natural gas over a short period of time, which drove the price of production down, actually, or drove the price of natural gas down below the cost of production. That can only go on for so long as they use up the best drilling locations, as I was explaining a minute ago. And we see the our analysis at Post Carbon Institute, we see the crossover point probably within the next 2 to 3 years, where the shale gas production begins to decline, and then that will mean a steeper overall decline in U.S. natural gas production because of the underlying decline of conventional natural gas. So here we've been promised 100 years of cheap natural gas, and even President Obama has said this in his most recent State of the Union address. And the reality is that we're going to probably be facing a natural gas supply crisis within the next 5 years.
Final question for you. The audience is worldwide right now. But a lot of them live in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And there are aggressive plans to build new fracking pipelines across the states. Recently, one pipeline was to pass just several miles from the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant, in my estimation, one of the most unsafe nuclear facilities in the country. Fortunately, it was defeated, even with the Army Corps of Engineers ruling it's unsafe. Another is being fought over that will go from Pennsylvania across New York near Albany and then cross over Massachusetts to the coast, perhaps with plans for export. And what I've come to learn is that only about 10% of the almost 300,000 miles of fracking gas pipelines in the United States are actually regulated. And these are especially high-pressurized lines, not like smaller lines that bring gas to our stoves. And there are incidents of massive fatal blowouts, sending plumes of fire hundreds of feet in the air. There are leaks and illegal dumping of toxic fracking fluids, and much more. Although we hear of the dangers to human life and the environment around fracking wells, we don't hear anything about the dangers of the massive infrastructure of pipelines to move natural gas around the country, and notably the largest energy transport company, Kinder Morgan, and spin of Enron, with horrendous records of lawsuits for illegal activities such as toxic dumping, regulatory violations, and accidents that have destroyed local environments. So share with us in your final comments the risk, the real risks, about these fracking gas pipelines.
Well, you're right that more and more of these pipelines are being built in order to move natural gas from areas where it's being produced temporarily in large quantities. Now, we have to understand that we're making a deal with the devil at every stage of this process. I mean, it's true that there are environmental trade-offs for every energy source. I mean, there are environmental costs for building solar panels or wind turbines. But when you look at shale gas and tight oil produced by hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling, the cost to the environment, to human health, are only beginning to be understood. And we're talking about massive rates of drilling, tens of thousands of wells being drilled, again, just to maintain current rates of production, let alone to grow production over the short period of time that the industry is going to be able to do that. So we are building this infrastructure that will be leaking, that will be causing environmental and health problems for years to come, all for the sake of a very short period where a few companies will be making a lot of money. We have to ask ourselves the question, is this really a beneficial trade-off for society as a whole? Yes, we need the natural gas right now because we're still dependent on it, but where's our long-range plan for transitioning away from depleting health and environment damaging fossil fuels toward other energy sources or a different mode of operating society? We have to have the long range plan, and that's probably the most important challenge facing our country right now. It's not being talked about because what we hear instead is the happy talk about the temporary abundance of oil and natural gas from fracking.
That's why we brought you on.
Well, thank you. Go ahead, Gary.
Richard, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we are going to be doing a two-hour special on challenging the existing energy sources of nuclear, coal, gas hydrofracking, and oil, and what the alternatives should be on an upcoming Progressive Commentary Hour two-hour special. And we'll have you back for an in-depth discussion on that.
I'd be happy
Thank you very much for being with us. RichardHeimberg.com. My guest, the book Snake Oil. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Now we don't have Luann available today, so let's go over and say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece. Is Utrece there? Not quite. All right. She'll be here in a moment, and I look forward to seeing more. I got to go film now, so I look forward to seeing all of you back here tomorrow. Have a nice day.